tell me about God. When I say God, tell me about God. What do you, who is God to you? What are some of your thoughts on this? Clearly, you're a smart man. You're a smart businessman. You've contemplated this before, or have you contemplated it?
I say God is the ultimate. You know, you look at this. You look at this incredible. Here we are in the Pacific Ocean. How did I ever own this? I bought it 15 years ago. I made one of the great deals, they say, ever, this piece of land. I have no mortgage on it.
We'll see that.
And I was able to, you know, buy this and make a great deal. That's what I want to do for the country, make great deals. We have to. We have to bring it back. But God is the ultimate. I mean, God created this. Yeah. And, you know, here's the Pacific Ocean right behind us. So nobody, no thing, no, there's nothing like God. Mm.
That, of course, is the person who currently occupies the White House, President Donald Trump. It, actually, the exchange happens in 2015. David Brody from the Christian Broadcasting Network is talking to him on a golf course of his, I guess, in Southern California. You hear a little bit of wind in the background there. That's what all that swooshing is. And so Donald Trump is explaining God largely in terms of his own business success, but also the beautiful nature that surrounds him. And it is a question that, I mean, it's, let me put it a different way. That's at least an answer. I don't think it's necessarily a particularly good or impressive answer. It might not even be an answer that would have sufficed in previous times of political history. But it's a necessary answer in American public life. It seems to be anyway. There have been candidates for president who really haven't been able to give an account of themselves with respect to their religious beliefs, who've seemed rather sterile on the subject. But their names tend to be like Dukakis and Mondale. They're people who like didn't get elected. Largely, if you're going to run for president in the United States, if you're going to attempt to lead this nation, you've got to explain yourself in terms of religion. And one could argue it was ever thus, and that it's our inheritance from the Puritans who came here in the first place. That's one of the subjects undertaken in American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present by Philip Gorski. Philip Gorski joins us now. He is a professor of sociology and religious studies at Yale University. And first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here, Colin.
I don't know if you'd ever heard that clip before.
No, I have to confess I hadn't.
I've actually now listened to it 5 times just because it's so perfect in so many ways. But I mean, well, first of all, we need to kind of set up what the landscape is of your book. And it's sort of a landscape with steep slopes on either side. On one side of this landscape is the steep slope of what you call religious nationalism. The notion essentially that political destiny and Christianity are braided inextricably together in the American story. You can't take them apart. You can't tell the American story, past, present, or future, without that in it somehow. And on the other end, radical secularism, the notion that, insofar as is possible, religion and religious matters need to be excluded from the public sphere, from the public debate. As a public radio host, I hear from people. I have, for example, talked to a religious secularist, one that I know pretty well, who informed me with an absolutely straight face that the Reverend Martin Luther King was a successful civil rights leader despite the fact that he was a Christian, despite the fact that he was a minister, that somehow or other that didn't get in the way of him being able to play an important role in the United States. There's radical secularism at its finest. But Philip Gorski, you're arguing that there is this complicated terrain in the middle of these two steep slopes. You do call it civil religion. Explain what it is that you mean when you're talking about that terrain.
Well, I would first like to say that I don't think it's a sort of a steep slope. I don't think it's a narrow path. I think it's actually a very wide path that can accommodate a lot of people, though I do think that there are maybe some steep cliffs, as it were, on either edge. And really the fundamental point that I'm trying to make in the book is that that the American tradition has both sacred and secular sources, and that those sacred and secular sources have been entwined really since the beginning of New England, the beginning of the United States, and that this creates space for people coming from different perspectives to engage with each other on this wide terrain of civil religion. I think you can embrace the core tenets of our civic creed. If you're a person of faith, or if you're a person of no faith, or if you're spiritual but not religious, or any of the other varieties that that Americans' beliefs come in.
So, if there is a civil religion that works like this, I mean, how do we know it when we see it? I mean, what are its qualities?
I think that when I first recognized that in American public life was in the 2008 campaign of Barack Obama for president, and I was stunned not just at how much I resonated to his message, but how many other people from many different races and classes and regions and parts of the country and backgrounds, how they resonated to it. I still remember being at a rally at the Hartford Excel Center.
I was there too.
Obama. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it was, and so you'll remember what the atmosphere was like. It really was almost a little bit like a religious revival. There was a lot of sort of a sense of joy and unity in the audience, kind of a sense of common purpose that Obama was able to evoke. And that was really, for me, the starting point of the book, was not just thinking not just about how I resonated, but how others resonated to that message, and trying to figure out how and why it was that Obama was so effective at playing on the mystic chords of our memory.
I recognize that quote. All right, so let's actually hear a little bit of a speech that Obama gave in 2008. It is the so-called A More Perfect Union speech. It is, in fact, a response to criticisms of his own religious experience at the church that he had been attending and some of the things that the pastor of that church had been saying. It's a speech that you talk about heavily in your book. So let's hear just a few seconds of that.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union. 221 years ago, a group of men gathered and with these simple words launched America's improbable experiment in democracy. The document they produced was eventually signed, but ultimately unfinished. It was stained by this nation's original sin of slavery. Of course, the answer to the slavery question was already embedded within our Constitution, a Constitution that promised its people liberty and justice and a union that could be and should be perfected over time.
He's doing a couple of different things there, Philip Gorski. I hear him invoking, I think, some of the things that you would call the civil religion. But he's also challenging American exceptionalism to a certain degree. I can tell you as a newspaper columnist that all you have to do is write that column. Say, I wrote it on July 4th a few years ago. I wrote it while I was sitting in France, which may have been significant. But I said, you know, look, that, you know, we had this Declaration of Independence. We had this war. We did this Constitution. You know, and at the end of the process, Dianne Feinstein, by the way, brought this up last week during the Neil Gorsuch hearings. At the end of this process, what did we have? We had a Constitution where slaves were still slaves and they weren't people, where women couldn't vote. You had a Declaration of Independence that really didn't, for example, regard Native Americans as full-fledged people. That there are sort of ways in which, for all the talk of American exceptionalism, we're a deeply flawed nation, which took a long time to outgrow its flaws, too. It took a long time to get women the vote. It took a long time to get rid of slavery, particularly compared to other European countries. So I don't know. I guess I want you to react to that. I mean, in a way, Obama is navigating both sides of that civil religion terrain.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that is one of the powers of the civil religious tradition, that it allows you to affirm the core tenets of the American experiment while at the same time acknowledging the ways in which we've fallen short of it. And the way that that Obama does this is by juxtaposing the principles that are in the preambles to the articles that are in both of those documents. So he says, all men are created equal, but there's the three-fifths clause. He says, we, the people of the United States, but some people have been excluded from full membership in the nation. And so he is using, he's holding up the articles against the principles in the preambles. And this was a way of interpreting those documents that Obama himself did not invent. It goes back, in fact, to Abraham Lincoln and before him, Frederick Douglass, who both read the founding documents in this redemptive way that that there is a promise that's been broken that still has to be redeemed. And Martin Luther King talks about the United States in the same way, about a check that has not been cashed, a promissory note that has not been honored.
So, you know, you make a very compelling case for the notion that President Obama really was very good at kind of navigating both sides of this question that you're exploring, that when he needed to, he could make the argument that religion needed to be kept out of certain aspects of the public sphere and the public debate. There were places where it didn't make any sense to tincture a debate with religious considerations. But he also could be plausibly religious, could invoke in a very plausible way his own religious background and the way that it informed his thinking. Although, just for fun, let's play a clip of a radical secularist who's no longer with us and who just wasn't having it. That will be Christopher Hitchens. You'll hear him during an appearance right here in Hartford.
Mr. Hitchens, on the radio you said you don't think Obama is a believer, even though he says he is. Why do you think that?
Well, it's my reading of his memoir, where he talks about the way that his mother explained to him how improbable it would be that there was any such thing as a divine intervention, and how he seems to find it persuasive and convincing, as indeed who would not. And then a few heartbeats later, he's saying, well, I'm in Chicago, I'm interested in a political career. I need to shop around and find some church in the community, because you can't do politics without shopping around for a church. And as all the world now knows, he picked the wrong one. And that's partly because he didn't particularly give a damn which one it was. And he dumped it when it no longer suited him. Furthermore, which you don't if you're a person of faith.
All right, so react to that, Philip Gorski.
Well, of course, Obama's faith has been questioned by people on both sides of the political spectrum, of course, by Dawkins and others. Dawkins, by the way, also questioned the sincerity of Martin Luther King's faith. And of course, there are people on the other side of the spectrum who have suspected, truly believe, I think, in many cases, that Obama is a secret Muslim, as Stephen Colbert often put it. I think that's a really very difficult judgment to make. I've read interviews, I've listened to speeches that he's given, and there is certain, my impression is that there is really something quite sincere in his expressions of religious belief. Now, those beliefs might not quite match the standards or be considered orthodox by others, but I'm just not inclined to question them in that way. I think that for the most part, we really simply have to take people's professions of religious faith more or less at face value and not question them in that way.
I would agree, and that's certainly my philosophy. But it's not everybody else's way. And I think you can make the argument that enough people, well, let me put it a different way. Not enough people accepted Barack Obama as this bearer of civil religion in a way that amounted to some kind of consensus and reconciliation in America. That, in a way, the opposite happened. We wound up with a very fractious and vulgar 2016 election in his wake. There seemed to be an awful lot of people who were essentially refighting the wars of 2008 and 2012, when the intention of winning this time, because there was no Barack Obama in the race, that it was a heated, vulgar, a xenophobic election that produced a fairly heated, vulgar, xenophobic president. So I respond to that. In other words, you look at all this and say, geez, for all of Barack Obama's best efforts, and they were very good, to synthesize all these traditions and find some interesting middle way, we wound up with maybe as polarized as we ever were.
Well, it's not really that surprising in a way. I think if you know the history of race relations in the United States, you know that it's often two steps forward, one step back, that progress is very long and very slow and very hard, and that when there is real progress, that some sort of a backlash follows. I don't want to suggest that everybody who disliked Obama was a racist or that everybody who voted for Trump is some sort of a white supremacist. That's completely unfair. But I do think it is the case that some people who found Barack Obama to somehow be foreign and un-American at some very deep level just had a difficult time accepting somebody of his race in the White House. And I think that was a not inconsiderable reason for the backlash that that followed his presidency.
So while reading your book, I thought a lot about this topic, and I've thought about it a lot about it my whole life. And one of the questions that I've had, particularly during my lifetime, I'm 62 years old, is that it's always seemed as though adherence to religion and Christian values are very much the province of conservatives and the religious right, and insistence on at least secularism in public affairs have been the province of the left. I mean, I just wrote a column about this the other day describing a debate that I was watching in 1979 when in the 1970s you couldn't do a living will in Connecticut because, in fact, the Catholic Church regarded it then as an abomination. And they had a lobbyist up the Capitol, and they would recruit people and make speeches and beat the whole thing down. And I was watching this debate, and there were Catholic politicians standing up there explaining why it's a usurpation of God's role and blah, blah, blah. And then the liberals would get up, and they would say, you can't introduce religion into this argument. It has no place in this argument. This is the state capitol. This is the state senate. We're trying to make a law here. Religion doesn't belong anywhere in this argument. And I remember turning to the person next to me and saying, you know, it's just kind of interesting that they don't think they have any right to argue the theological point, right? That you could easily make a theological argument that, you know, if I'm essentially dead and on a ventilator, God already has snipped the thread of my life. And the real abomination is keeping me alive, and the hubris is keeping me alive by human and medical and scientific means. But they don't want to go near that because it feels like a landmine to them. And I guess I'm wondering, A, why you think that is, and B, whether you think it ever gets healed, whether or not you think that the religious argument is always owned by the right.
Well, the religious argument has certainly not always been owned by the right. In some quarters of American culture and society, it certainly still isn't owned by the right. If you think about, in particular, the Black church tradition. If you think, for example, about many segments of evangelicalism today, which are moving more towards the left and the center, I think that we're going to see more theological engagement around some of these issues in the years to come.
What gives you? I mean, I think you might be right about that, but well, let's just talk about that for a second. It's worth talking about. I feel that that's happening not because politicians or political leaders are learning to talk about that on the center and left sides of the issue, but because religion is moving faster than politics. That, you know, for example, the Southern Baptist Convention and a bunch of other evangelical groups have identified climate change as a moral imperative. And the Southern Baptist Convention criticized, as in 2008, they criticized their previous position as too timid, you know, that this is a moral thing. It's really important to do. Now, think about that vis-a-vis Republican politics. I mean, they just in no way have they caught up to the Southern Baptist Convention. Southern Baptist Convention also recently critiqued very strongly Trump's policy on immigration and said, you are not, it doesn't seem to recognize our belief that humanity includes people of all faiths and that they're all God's children and all this kind of stuff. That I feel as though conservative religion is getting less conservative. I mean, the Catholic Church, their conclave elected Pope Francis. I don't know that the political sphere understands that. I mean, I still hear from Mike Pence the same stuff that I would hear 15 years ago. I don't react to that.
I think that's exactly right. I think that there is an old guard of the religious right that still dominates public discussion, but that they are in many ways increasingly out of touch with the people in the pews. And you're beginning to see all kinds of splits. So I think the root of these splits, as you rightly said, is that a lot of evangelicals and conservative Christians have much more complicated political and ethical agendas, that it's not all about the pelvic issues anymore for these people. They care about sex trafficking and social justice and environmental stewardship and many other things. I think this is particularly pronounced amongst evangelicals of color and the younger generation of evangelicals. I think there's also increasing tension around issues of gender equality within evangelical churches, in part because there are so many women who are rising up to positions of pastoral leadership. And some of these tensions rose to the surface during the 2016 campaign. One of the most eye-opening incidents in this regard for me was when a group of students at Liberty University, which is Jerry Falwell's university in Lynchburg, Virginia now, governed by his son, Jerry Falwell Jr., a group of students actually challenged Jerry Falwell Jr. for his support of Trump. And that was something that I think would have been really hard to imagine 5 or even 10 years ago. And that really sort of opened my eyes to just how deep some of these splits may be. And I know personally any number of people who were raised as conservative evangelicals who still believe the things that they were raised to believe, and yet are increasingly uncomfortable with the label evangelical because of the political valence that it has. And I think that the fronts may really be shifting, and that the fact that this may really in some ways be a last go-round for some of that old guard conservative evangelical leadership.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break. We're talking to Philip Gorski. His new book is American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present. We'll be back after this. None left to say, part of the land of the free, home of the brave, the founding fathers rolled in the grave.
Take our country back. And it couldn't happen soon enough. I think Washington, D.C., you'd think by now they'd get the message. An earthquake, a hurricane. Are you listening? The American people have done everything they possibly can. Now it's time for an act of God, and we're getting it.
That's Michelle Bachmann, of course, with the kind of rhetoric that we're kind of familiar with. I mean, it sounds at times ludicrous, but it doesn't sound ludicrous to everybody. Right now we're talking about the stress and strain that has existed over the centuries here in the United States between religious nationalism. You just heard one of the people who professes it ardently, and radical secularism, people who believe that religion should be kept out of the public sphere as much as possible. Philip Gorski is the author of American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present. He's a professor of sociology and religious studies at Yale University. So First of all, this book, in a way that we can't possibly cover in a one-hour radio show, really delves into the history of this and explores a lot of really interesting figures, from Reinhold Niebuhr to W.E.B. Du Bois, and looks at our Puritan background, which we'll talk a little bit about here. But I want to invoke another religious historian based at Yale. He's not with us anymore. His name is Sidney Ahlstrom. He wrote The Religious History of the American People. And so he made the argument, Philip Gorski, that, and I, as much as I admired him, I think he turned out to be wrong, that in 1960, the American theocracy ended. That in 1960, Americans elected a Catholic, which was improbable. It was the first time somebody had been elected president who was not a Protestant, and a self-professing, self-avowing Protestant. And that this represented a real turning point in American history. Now, the reality is, 57 years later, we haven't done anything like that. We've elected a whole bunch more Protestants. In 1980, there were three major candidates for president. They all claimed to be born-again Christians: Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, and John Anderson. And even Donald Trump, who's not really very persuasive as a Christian, when he went to Liberty University, he forgot that you're not supposed to say words like hell and damn in your speech. He cited 2 Corinthians, which is really not how biblical people talk about 2 Corinthians. And his so-called spiritual advisor right now is a Florida televangelist, a thrice married blonde woman who's currently married to one of the members of the rock group Journey, who, after all, did do Don't Stop Believing. But, I mean, he's maybe less plausible as a religious person than a lot of presidents have been. But still, I feel like he had to put that cloak on. So what has changed? If anything has changed in our understanding of religion in the public sphere, what is it?
I think you're right to say that for most of American history, there has been a kind of de facto or informal Protestant establishment that has dominated our culture, that has dominated our public life, and that has been very slow to let go of that. Liberal Protestantism let go of it in the early or mid-20th century, and into the space it was left by them rushed evangelicals of various sorts in alliance with conservative Catholics and conservative Jews, but with Protestants, as you rightly note, still in a sense really being the most visible and influential part of the triad. On the other hand, look at the Supreme Court. That's really stunning. There's not a single Protestant on the Supreme Court as currently constituted. It's all Catholics and Jews, and I think those are groups that have enormous influence over our public discourse, even if they are not always the faces that we see at a presidential debate. And I think it's also remarkable and stunning was Mitt Romney's nomination, a Mormon, after all, one of the most marginalized and persecuted religious minorities within the U.S. During the 19th and up through the early 20th century, and there was relatively little murmuring about that. So I think that generally speaking, we have become much more accepting of religious diversity, but I think at the same time there is this ongoing sense of loss amongst American Protestants, this sort of yearning to have the kind of influence that they had for much of our history.
Although we should note that there's an Episcopalian on the way in the Supreme Court. And I think Gorsuch is an interesting argument on behalf of one of your premises, or maybe even the ethos of your book, in this sense, anyway. So you've got, I think one of the things that happens in these hearings to confirm a Supreme Court justice, I mean, they're not going to talk about how they would rule in the future. They get asked days and days of questions. So what are those questions about? And I think they are, to a certain degree, questions about the degree to which the candidate is identifiably participating in the American civil religion. In other words, Barack Obama and Neil Gorsuch are very, very different people politically, but they kind of belong in that same universe that you're talking about. Gorsuch's job over those 3 days was to prove that he wasn't some kind of outlier, that he subscribed to a whole basic set of ideas that were the same ideas that lots of mainstream politicians do. And I do think religiously, he's, by the way, the member of a pretty darn liberal Episcopalian congregation in Boulder, Colorado. I think that one thing that does happen is that religious people these days, as opposed to the period, the 80s period that you document in your book, where Falwell and Robertson and people like that were getting really out there, out in front with their religious beliefs, is, you know, Sarah Palin kind of didn't want people to know that she had been a member of a Pentecostal Assembly of God. She really kept that on the down low, trying to find out what denomination Mike Pence really belongs to these days. It's really hard to do. I mean, I know the answer, but he doesn't strut that kind of thing, right? If there's a proof of your premise for me, Philip Gorski, it's kind of that. It's that it's almost the Gorsuch hearings are perfect. It's like, here's a guy saying, yeah, I might have some really conservative beliefs, but I'm kind of normal. You know what I'm saying? Does it make any sense to you?
Sure, absolutely. I like to say that our civic creed as it exists currently has four core tenets. So freedom, equality, inclusion, and solidarity. And what exactly each of those terms means and how you harmonize them is not an easy question to answer, and different people answer the question differently. But I think being part of our civic community does involve some kind of public affirmation that those are values that we all share, even if we can't right now agree on exactly what they mean, and that people who reject those values are oftentimes, and I think rightly, seen as really outside of the mainstream of the American experiment. And so this is why I think, for example, the sort of resurgence of kind of racial supremacists and racial separatist doctrines in the United States is really quite worrisome, because it rejects this central tenet of equality, these central tenets of equality and inclusion.
So I wondered what would happen if I posed the same set of questions, including the Gorsuch questions, to somebody who was really pretty much on the extreme right, or pretty much on the far right. So yesterday I talked to Dennis Prager. He hosts a talk show that's kind of the conservative talk show for people who think that Rush Limbaugh jokes around too much. Dennis is pretty darn serious and very, very conservative. And so here's a little bit of that conversation. So as we look at the present moment, it does seem as though there are places where you can find, in interesting ways, I don't know, maybe sort of friction points here between those two visions, a kind of secular vision and a religious vision. I mean, you can kind of see it all over the country right now. You can see it in North Carolina right now as they're trying to sort out the HB2 question. Although I noticed, Dennis, maybe you don't see it the same way. I feel like in 1985, 1990, with Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson in full flower, that would have been argued much more religiously than it's being argued right now. That, in fact, if you look at most of the rhetoric around HB2, it really has more to do with privacy and different visions of what, you know, fairness are. You don't hear quite as much religion invoked in this conversation.
I agree with you on that. I agree with you, because people who attend college in the United States have attended a sort of secular seminary, and religious ideas are held in contempt. So using any religious idea, or let alone the Bible, to buttress an argument is not going to resonate with the vast majority of Americans today, because of the radical secularism that you just mentioned. And I think that's a sad thing. You are taught in America today, in subtly or not subtly, that those who believe in God and take God and the Bible seriously are fools. So clearly then, you're not going to have any politician, wisely, I would add, using any religious argument to buttress his position.
Do you see any movement towards the center from either one of these groups? I guess what I'm intrigued by is the question of whether or not it's possible. I mean, I'm sort of hopeful that there is an identifiable center, particularly an identifiable center around these kinds of issues. One person that who has come to intrigue me a bit is Neil Gorsuch. Now, Neil Gorsuch, I think, is somebody who ideologically is very satisfying to most conservatives. He's also belongs to a pretty liberal church in Boulder, Colorado. His pastor was in the Women's March to Washington. They, you know, hew to a pretty typically liberal set of mainline Protestant beliefs about the environment, about gay marriage, stuff like that. And then you've got Neil Gorsuch, who's Neil Gorsuch. Because I'd like to believe that there's a place that includes, there's an ideological place that includes a guy like President Obama, who clearly does have some kind of religious background, some kind of understanding of religion. And then there's Neil Gorsuch, who's obviously, you know, much more conservative than Obama, but also a religious person, but belonging to a church that probably sounds a lot more like a President Obama type of church.
I assure you that this may make your day, but I will just be open with you. That fact does concern a fair number of conservatives because I think that people are affected by the pastor, rabbi, or priest that they hear every Saturday or Sunday. And it makes perfect sense. Not everybody is. There are conservative Jews who attend Reform and conservative synagogues who are disgusted by the almost radical sermons that they regularly hear from the pulpit at synagogue. But so those people stayed conservative despite their clergy, and he might stay conservative despite his clergy, Neil Gorsuch. I agree with you. But a lot of people are affected, and rightly so. It would be very depressing to think that you can go every week to synagogue or church and not be affected by your clergyman.
All right. Well, listen, Dennis Prager, thanks for your time today.
Good to be with you. Okay. Thanks.
So, Philip Gorski, I'll just sort of let you react to that. What did you hear in that conversation?
I guess I would have to a little bit leap to the defense of American colleges and universities, perhaps not so surprisingly. I think what often happens, as happens with many things in our public discussions on the media, is that a few particularly radical people or a few particularly unfortunate events get picked up and then presented as if they really represented the whole of reality. Listen, I teach a freshman seminar on the history of political thought here at Yale, and these kids are all over the political spectrum. I mean, from the far right to the far left, and some of them are very religious and some of them are not religious at all, and others are somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. And, you know, we really do manage to have very deep and engaged and thoughtful and respectful conversations. And I think the same has been true with some of the events here and elsewhere that have been reported on, that, you know, there was a lot of reporting, for example, about a few confrontations that happened last year here at Yale over the Halloween costumes incident that some people may have heard about. And yet what doesn't get reported on is the incredible number of very thoughtful discussions that the students had amongst themselves, that they had with the heads of their residential colleges. You know, I think that it's unfortunate. I know that this happens too when the left sort of picking up on stuff that happens on the right and imagining that every conservative is, I don't know, like Maya Yiannopoulos or somebody like that, right? Who's just a sensationalist.
I think we can, I think maybe Dennis Prager has dragged us off the topic that we're supposed to be on. Anyway, I'm going to just wrap that part of it up right here and go to a break. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more.
There's no way to hide it. The divided states of America. Tied in every area. Getting kind of scared of you. The divided states of America, yeah.
Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. The Reverend Amanda Fish supervised all religious content, and our intern is Hazel Colon. The part of Bill Curry was played by Pat Robertson. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and most other podcast platforms. We'll be back tomorrow with a discussion of S-Town, the addictive new podcast from the Serial and This American Life team. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. We have been talking today about the dynamic tension between radical secularism, like that notion that, and you hear more of it and more of it these days, expressed by a wide range of commentators from Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, to Penn Jillette, the magician, the notion that that religion must be excluded from all arguments in the public marketplace of ideas, as opposed to sort of a religious nationalism. That's the term that Philip Gorski uses in his book American Covenant: A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present. Philip Gorski is with us now. Also joining us for this segment is Daryl Hart, a professor of history at Hillsdale College in Michigan, author of Damning Words, The Life and Religious Times of H.L. Mencken. So, Daryl Hart, you've probably heard a little bit of this conversation. I know you've read the book. I know that you've reviewed the book. And we haven't really had time in this hour to talk that much about the historical arguments that are in this book. But overall, what do you make of Philip Gorski's argument that there is kind of a middle way, a civil religion that's found expression in people like Niebuhr and Du Bois and Obama and Jefferson, that you can look around and find this as the synthesis of these two strains?
Well, I think that's true historically, and it accounts for some of it. Part of my objection has been that who it leaves out, and not simply does he put in the outsider camp people like my friend or favorite person H.L. Mencken, among others, but also Thomas Jefferson. So there's that side of it, but there's also then the neglect of this use of civil religion by 20th century presidents for engaging in American foreign policy, that I think if that were part of the picture, I wonder if Professor Gorski would be as positive about civil religion. And I'm affected by having read most recently Walter McDougall's book on civil religion and American foreign policy, and it's quite a scathing indictment of civil religion. So there is a a positive side to civil religion, of course, and it is a way to unify, but it also has been a way to unify the nation for some, say, American involvement overseas and conceptions of America as a great or exceptional nation that also I think we would want to back away from.
Philip Gorski, I'd like to hear you respond to this a little bit. I will say that obviously George W. Bush cast the involvement in Iraq in starkly religious terms. I would call it religious nationalism as opposed to civil or civic religion. I don't think that's what Professor Hart is talking about, though. But how about civil religion in our foreign policy?
Well, I actually agree completely with Professor Hart about this. And that's why I try very hard in the book to draw a clear and bright line in between what I call civil religion and religious nationalism. And the way I define religious nationalism in the book, it has two elements. One is apocalypticism, and then the other is blood rhetoric of various kinds. So apocalypticism in the sense of there's a end times, a final cosmic showdown between the forces of good and evil, and we know exactly who those forces are. The line between good and evil runs between peoples as opposed to through individual people. So that there's the belief, in my view, the fantasy, that it is possible for human beings to really rid the world of evil by their own powers. And then related to this is this blood rhetoric of conquest and the ultimate sacrifice to the nation. And I completely agree with Walter McDougall that version of civil religion, I don't want to call it civil religion, but that what I would call a kind of heretical version of civil religion, has played a very destructive role in American history, and because of that also in global history. And I think that the difference with the civil religion is that civil religion, first of all, you know, the idea is that America is supposed to lead by example. I think that's really the best way to understand this, the shining city on a hill or city on a hill example is, you know, it's not a fortress on a hill. It's not, you know, a battleship or a battle station on a hill. It's a fortress on a hill, and the leadership is supposed to be by example. And there is also this notion of a higher set of principles that that the country and its people are constantly falling short of, and that this necessitates a kind of a certain degree of humility and contrition on our part, which is not to say, you know, apologizing for everything that we've done and not seeing the ways in which America has been a force for good in the world now and again.
Let me just jump in so we don't run out of time. But Daryl Hart, it seems to me like maybe one of the people that Professor Gorski invokes successfully in this regard is Reinhold Niebuhr, who's you know, a proponent of that version of civil religion, which does not admit that level of religious jingoism, that notion that America's ambition should go unchallenged. Niebuhr says, criticizes the Spanish-American War on that basis, right? I mean, I would assume that's the good version.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that every good version has also bound up with it the bad versions, and that's what I would have liked to have seen more in Professor Gorski's book. So Niebuhr, at the same time that he's maybe, I think he is in some ways posturing a more modest understanding of the Cold War and calling for a kind of humility on America's part. He's also, though, very much opposed to Roman Catholic developments in the United States, and he's very much opposed to the removal of prayer and Bible reading from public schools. And so that kind of civil religion, which casts America in a kind of Protestant frame, has been a problem for people who aren't Protestants, including some secularists and atheists. And at the same time, FDR calling America into World War II and Woodrow Wilson calling America into World War I mean, there would be lots of Americans who would think those were noble wars, but on the other side of it, there were consequences that came with that may have tempted America into a kind of pride about being the leader of the free world and more that goes with it. So if civil religion simply called us to greater humility, that would be great, but it seems the way that many people, both on the left and the right, use moral claims in political discourse is to show how bad the other side is, and I would really like to be relieved of that, but that's just my personal preference.
All right, we got about a minute left. Philip Gorski, I'll give you the last word.
Well, again, I really do find myself in agreement with Professor Hart about this, and I think that one thing which the United States really could use is more voices like Niebuhr's, with all of his limitations and shortcomings and failings, certainly, which there are many, and you identify the ones that I would also identify as well. But I look for those sort of prophetic voices again in our public life, which you know, can kind of preach a Jeremiah or two and make us realize the errors of our ways, but not just in the sense of turning, you know, the history of the United States into a history of victimization and oppression, you know, also seeing the possibility for redeeming some of our ideals and promises, if not in the present, then perhaps in the future. And understanding the United States as an intergenerational project and one that's important that we keep pursuing. I think in many ways the importance of the American experiment in democracy is grown. If our aspiration is to be a nation of nation and a people of peoples, to somehow reconcile deep pluralism with democracy, well, that's a project whose urgency could never have been greater in a globalizing world in which many people aspire to democracy and in which there are many people who would like to do away with it for the sake of homogeneity and authority.
All right, we're going to have to stop there. The book is American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present. Philip Gorski is the author. Thanks also to Dennis Prager for joining us, and Daryl Hart, professor of history at Hillsdale College, the author of Damning Words, The Life and Religious Times of H.L. Mencken. Thanks to Josh Nalea for producing. We'll be back tomorrow with a nose.